The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 982. It's the 1st of February 2018. On the podcast today, I have Andrew Walwin, CEO of Satellite Solutions Worldwide, that's SAT, and Andrew discusses their recent bullish trading update. Plus, I also have on Dr. Jonathan Forster, CEO of Cora Gold, that's C-O-R-A, and Jonathan explains why he's extremely encouraged by the high-grade gold intercepts at his flagship Sanankora gold discovery in southern Mali. Plus, Jerry Randall, CEO of Venture Life Group, that's VLG, gives us a trading update where revenues for the full year are expected to be over £16 million and EBITDA of £1.7 million. And that's not bad going when you consider their market cap is below 17 million, or around about 16 million. Also on the podcast, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, talks about Royal Dutch Shell, Unilever, and Vodafone. And as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andrew Walwin, CEO of Satellite Solutions Worldwide. That's SAT ticker. Andrew, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. Good to be back on the show.
Yeah, I know you've had what seems like a very positive trading update, and we'll get to that in a bit, the detail of that, the finer detail. But before we do that, Andrew, for people listening right now, they've just tuned in, or they're new to investing, new to the podcast, and they've never heard of the company. Explain to them, in summary, what are you all about?
Basically, we give people fast broadband that can't get decent broadband. So if you're out in the sticks and you're too far from a BT or a TalkTalk cabinet in the UK or in any of the countries that we're in, we come along, put something on the side of your house, and that will give you speeds of anywhere between 50 meg and 100. So it's connecting the people who are suffering from the digital divide. And currently, we're in 31 countries.
Wow, and you've done so many deals. But if someone's listening right now and thinking, is that still a problem with people in the countryside, or isn't it being sorted out by the bigger companies, the broadband providers? What would your response to that be?
Well, what you see is any new technology always starts in a city. Mm-hmm. And whether it's 2G, 4G, 5G, if we talk about fiber, because that's where the population density is. The further you move out, so when you get to the villages, yes, you may see villages themselves being connected, and that is what's called fiber to the cabinet. So the fiber comes to that cabinet, but then you've still got the old copper lines going out to the houses. But if you're roughly, and the rule of thumb is 4 kilometres from a cabinet in a village, you know, it's just too expensive to upgrade you. So those people at the very end of the line are the people that will always sort of be without.
Yeah, yeah. And that will always kind of happen. So as everyone gets faster and faster, they'll always be at the end of the queue, won't they? And they'll always be, you know, slow in comparison to everything else. And of course, we're using more data than ever. And as we get more sophisticated and programs and stuff we use become more intricate, we're using more data. So we need that bandwidth, don't we, to grow?
It's a bit like a river or a stream. Mm. You know, if you are basically, as people consume more data, that means if you're further upstream, yeah, you're getting less and less access. So what people do see as well, even people who are on a reasonable connection, what they're tending to see, the kids come home from school, 3 o'clock, and they lose all their bandwidth because people closer to the cabinet are consuming that.
Yeah, yeah, okay. All right, let's get into the trading update. So it says, subtitle is strong growth during 2017 and a positive outlook for 2018 and beyond. Sounds like Buzz Lightyear there. go for it, Andrew. Take us through some of the detail here, please.
I think the important thing is we are a roll-up strategy. You know, we are acquiring companies throughout Europe and Australia and growing those customer bases. But what people always ask me is, what is the underlying performance like? So it is important that if we acquire a business, that we acquire it for a reason that we can then grow it faster. And I think the important number that people always focus on with us is what are the organic revenues. And they're still growing at a double-digit rate. So that's from our original core business. So or the businesses that we've acquired, we come along, we overlay our sales and marketing plans on that, and they're growing. And that will always continue. So that was very positive to see that.
Yeah.
The overall revenues themselves, you know, we've doubled year on year. And the recurring revenue, you know, it's the majority. It's over 40 million of our revenue is recurring. So if we did nothing else tomorrow, that revenue is always going to be there. So, yeah, some really good, solid results. We're still relatively new on AIM, you know, just over 2 years. So, yeah, good. We're good, really. We're pleased with it.
Yeah, and I suppose with acquisitions, I mean, people can get concerned about, you know, when you add a company, you've got to make sure it's value adding in some way, and that the cost you're paying for that, you know, doesn't exceed the benefit. So, I mean, so if people ask you, so how are you acquiring these? You know, what's it costing you? How do you know they're going to be value accretive? What do you say?
Well, it's a pretty small industry that we're in. That's the first thing. So actually, we know most of the companies in the sector. You know, if you look at the whole of Europe, there is really about 50 to 70 companies in our industry. If we look across Australia, where we are, it's maximum of 15 to 20. So you get an understanding over the years of what sort of businesses those are. So we know the ones that we want, and we know the ones that we want to stay well away from. So that's the first thing, just on the historical information that we have. We then have a set of matrix that we look at, and if they fall into that, then it works for us. If it doesn't, the important thing is that we get them integrated as soon as possible once they're on board. Our sort of unique sort of what drives us forward is our systems that we have. It allows us to integrate people quickly, improve the billing. A lot of the smaller companies that we acquire are still billing sort of on Excel spreadsheets. You know, we get them in, customer gets access to our portal, improves their customer experience, reduces churn, and that's what enables us to grow those bases once they're sitting, you know, within us.
Yeah, and so it says you've completed 7 acquisitions in that period. And what about 2018? I mean, obviously it's not a numbers game, but are you going to be as acquisitive as you were in 2017?
Yeah, in 2018, yes. I mean, when we came to market, we used a sort of broad brush sort of statistic saying we'd get to 100,000 customers by Christmas 2017, which we achieved early. And I think that we will continue growing like that. I think that by 2020, you know, next couple of years, we'll have certainly increased by 50% and got to 150,000 customers just on organic alone. But we do have we like acquisitions, you know, and if the right ones are out there, we will follow those up as well.
Yeah, excellent stuff. All right, Andrew, if someone's listening to this and likes the sound of where you're headed and your strategy, but are not following the story yet, give them 3 quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list.
I think every month we add more customers. We've always done that, you know, right from the days when we were founded. That is important, that we're growing month on month. The majority of that revenue is recurring, and that will continue. There'll certainly be no changes there. We, in fact, see, you know, the actual ARPUs creeping up. And I think the important thing is we're really beginning to see the benefits of scale coming through. We're seeing our negotiations with the networks and our general operating overhead improving, which is dropping through to EBITDA. Those are the 3 key things that have always been the main thread throughout the business and just will continue to improve through 2018.
Marvellous stuff. And by the way, if you do hit the follow button on Satellite Decisions, you will get anything they post, any RNS that comes out straight to the front screen of your phone. Andrew, good to chat to you. Like I say, you've been very busy in 2017, and you reckon it'll be the same, much the same in 2018. So no doubt we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks as always.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Jonathan Forster, CEO of Cora Gold. That's Cora, ticker. Jonathan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. Great to be with you again.
Now, you've had some decent results out, or it says they're impressive initial results, and they look very impressive, and we'll get to that in a bit. But for people listening right now, and they're not sure what you do, Cora Gold is a little hint in the title there, a little clue. But for people not aware of them, what are you all about? Where are you based? What are you doing, Jonathan?
Yeah, Justin, we're Cora Gold. We're a West African gold exploration company, very much focused in Mali. We listed on AIM just 3 months ago when we raised £3.5 million for our exploration programs. The focus in Mali is on those highly prospective Birimian gold belts. And importantly, we've got senior management that have worked together in Mali and West Africa for over 20 years. And we have the ability to operate professionally and efficiently in the country. And I think that's been shown by bringing our first drill results to the market so quickly.
Yeah, and it's always worth highlighting that, isn't it? Because you often hear, I often get companies on the podcast who talk about their assets and what they're doing there. But the jurisdiction in which you operate is very important. And I know Mali has a reputation for being one of the most sort of mining-friendly countries, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, it has been it's been a very productive country in terms of gold discoveries and turning into gold mines. Mm. And because of that, and as a consequence, the government is very supportive. Mm-hmm. And, you have some of the major players operating in the country.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go through some of these initial results that are very impressive, as stated in the RS. So take us through them, Donald. What do they mean?
Well, first of all, the results, we're calling it Target 1.
Yeah.
And this is an area at Sanankoro, our focused project, which is away from the areas that previously were drilled in any systematic way by RC drilling. So these results reflect a new discovery, and I think that is an important point to mention. And so to emphasize then, I think that this really was reconnaissance drilling, and that means that we're putting these drill fences in about 320 meters apart. And if you think about that on the ground, if you're walking somewhere, that's a long way, actually.
Yeah.
And so to identify those, the target in there with the structure within there, we do have to drill sort of a number of holes along the line. And so it is the very early stage of making discoveries. And I think what's been delightful for me is that these results really confirm the presence of a gold discovery, and more importantly, with potentially economic widths and grades, over an area of at least 1.2 kilometers length of the 1.5 kilometers that we drilled. And if I just also mention that we also drilled one additional fence on what we believe is the same structure, a further 1.7 kilometers to the south, and again got some good intercepts. So although it's still early days, but I think this is hugely encouraging. Yeah. And I think tied with that, the gold grades and widths, is the presence of a deep weathering of the rock, and the visible gold that we've talked about before, mm-hmm. really just does mean that potentially as you move forward one day towards the mining and processing stages, that you've got these benefits that bring down operating costs.
Yeah. And so can you put these sort of these results into context for people not aware?
So if we recall that Sanankoro, our focus project here, it's really a 15-kilometer-long gold zone with multiple structures in it. Mm-hmm. And previously, only 1.6 kilometers of that on a single structure had been drilled in any systematic way by Goldfields. So what our work has done is to take the bold step of moving nearly 7 kilometers to the north along a separate structure as well, to start the process trying to define scale to this project. And I think the results confirm that the gold mineralization exists, and through sort of our surface work, the mapping, previous RAB drilling and artisanal workings, I think there's very good surface evidence that we may be able to link this target one that we've just drilled back towards the zone B along more than something like a 7 kilometer length. So that really is starting to describe the sort of scale.
Yeah.
And I think, impressive as this is, one has to bear in mind that we actually have additional multi-kilometer parallel structures yet to test. So the whole belt potentially has enormous scale.
It sounds enormous. And at the moment, like you said, you suggest in the RNS, it's all very encouraging. But You must be sort of trying to contain your excitement a little bit, you know?
Well, as an exploration geologist, every morning I think the most exciting thing is I get indications of what we've drilled the day before.
Yeah.
Is it gets me out of bed and gets me in front of the desk and keeps me excited. Never know with in this business the next drill hole what it's going to bring you.
Well, talking about the next drill hole, what is the current program and where are you going with this?
So we're in the middle of a current 4,000-meter program, having building on that first program that we did. And this one now is testing selected zones on some of these other structures. And with that, we hope to continue to build up an inventory of sort of additional discoveries. And then eventually what we'll do is we'll, having identified these discoveries, we'll turn around and start doing the infill and resource drilling. And in parallel with that, to help us sort of track the structures on the ground, we'll soon be starting a ground geophysics program.
Excellent stuff. All right, well, Jonathan, if anyone's listening to this and secretly getting as excited as you are about this, but they're not following you yet, not following the story, give them the three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I think three reasons. First of all, you know, our primary project here really does have the potential for a large-scale gold deposit. With our first target threshold of that more than 1 million ounces of mainly oxides of shallow resources, I think that target is enhanced by this first round of drill results. Mm-hmm. Secondly, Kora also has a portfolio of projects within potential trucking distance of our 34% shareholder Hummingbird. And, of course, Hummingbird recently announced its first gold pour from Yanfolila mine. Mm-hmm. We have a drill program planned for the first two targets close to this Hummingbird mine this quarter, which, if successful, I think could lead towards fast-tracking resource definition to take advantage of that nearby plant. The third one, our third point, and I think we have to come back to the management team, which has an extensive track record of making discoveries in Africa that do become mines. And I think that the way that we've gone from listing to first discovery in 3 months really is testimonial to this. And so coupled with our intimate knowledge of Mali, I think we really are looking forward to taking Kora forward and continuing to build on our initial results and success.
Excellent, Jonathan. Well, you're keeping busy there, and the work program looks very exciting, and so no doubt we'll get some more results in the not-too-distant future. So I look forward to chatting to you then. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks, Justin. Good to talk to you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jerry Randall, CEO of Venture Life Group. That's VLG. Jerry, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Justin. You're welcome.
Now, you've just released a training update, which looks quite good from my perspective, but we'll get the detail from you in a bit. Before we do, for people listening right now, tuned in and thinking, what Venture Life do? Summarise what the business is all about, please, Jerry, if you could.
Sure. Venture Life is a vertically integrated consumer self-care company. So we develop, manufacture, commercialise products for the self-care market. So they're products that you'd buy at the pharmacy, pay for yourself, take home and treat yourself with. They're generally for conditions affecting more the aging population than the rest of us, so things such as cholesterol, cognitive function, joint pain, etc. But these are products sold around the world. We sell in over 40 countries, and our end customers will go to the pharmacy, choose the product themselves, treat themselves, and pay for themselves. So we have operations in the UK, in Italy. We make all the products ourselves, and we're on a nice sort of growth curve of good revenue growth.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, your trading update, expected revenues of over £16 million, EBITDA of over £1.7 million. And this is quite impressive considering you are around about £16 million market cap.
I know.
So take us through the detail here, John.
Of course, yeah. I mean, we've seen good organic growth in across our business. We had no acquisitions during 2017. It's all organic growth of over 12%. And that's just come from our products going into more countries and our customers and partners in those countries growing those products as well. We've got a portfolio of products. They're backed by clinical data. Some have patents. We have formulation protection, brand protection. And each of those are partnered in countries around the world with good partners who then grow those in-market sales themselves. So we seen that growth coming through. We've seen new partnerships being signed, particularly on our Ultradex range, where we signed deals last year in Italy and France and Scandinavia, and they'll all be launching in market this year. So good revenue growth. And because we've got a fixed cost base, virtually fixed cost base, when we increase revenue and therefore gross margin, the majority of that is flowing through to the bottom line, which is why you're seeing our EBITDA growing much faster percentage-wise than our revenue. And that will continue as we go forward.
Yeah, well, that's always nice to hear that, because, people, I mean, obviously the performance of a share price is pretty much all about what's happening in the future. So it's nice to hear that. And so at the moment, I just look at the chart there, and you hit a recent low, and now it's bounced up, it's come back a little bit. So I know most any CEO I get on the podcast will say, yes, we are a bargain here. But, you know, you've got a good case to argue here, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. I think we're obviously sitting in the small cap market space, and I know that's a market space that's not had a good run, I suppose, in recent years. But essentially, we are now a growing, profitable, fully integrated global business. We don't rely on any external factors now to grow our business. We've got good, strong portfolio. We're valued this year at less than 1x revenue, which is quite ridiculous. If you look at any of the M&A transactions that happen in our space, people are paying 3-4x revenue for businesses and products like us. So we are significantly undervalued. But the most important thing is, you know, we're moving into a phase of the business now where we're profitable, we're going to be generating cash, and we're going to be growing profitably. We're going to do more M&A as well. So if you look on just fundamentals, you know, we are very undervalued and would be a great time to get in. I mean, we as a management team still own a third of the business, and we're as excited about the business as ever.
Yeah, and it's, like I say, it's growing. And of course, I don't think we've covered this, but your last announcement, you were announced European Business Awards as one's to watch list. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I mean, we've had a number of awards over the last few years in this company space. For 2 years running, we've been in the Stock Exchange's 1,000 Businesses to Inspire. From the UK, we've been in this award for ones to watch. So I think what's different about us is in our sort of market cap space, you've got a lot of, I would say, sort of commodity stocks or maybe some biotech stocks where the share price is a binary result. Either the reserves come off or the tests come off and the product's approved and it goes to the roof, or it doesn't happen and it goes to the floor. We're not like that. We're going to have steady, long-term organic growth now driving through to the profitability line. And that will go on, and we're self-sustainable in that process. Plus, we can bolt on some fantastic additional acquisitions like we did with Ultradex, which will just put more and more profitability on the bottom line. So we're a safe bet, strong business, good steady long-term organic growth, and, you know, on fundamentals, undervalued. I think Northland's at the moment, the latest broker note, you know, the target share price is 94p, and we're sat at 46-47. So, you know, it's a good opportunity for good long-term profitable, safe investment.
Yeah, well, listen, you've almost done it there, but talking about ones to watch, so Jerry, summarise three bullet points. If someone's listening to this right now, why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list. Why should they do that?
We're in an interesting space. We're in a great demographic. So we're in the area of self-care, which is growing rapidly at the moment. So we've got a growing market space and we're already ready positioned in there. Secondly, we're now a profitable business, and this year will be cash generative business, so we're self-sustaining. No need to worry about having to come back to the market for money to keep growing. We've got the full integrated operations to deliver that. And finally, we've got a share price sat at 50% of the target price of the brokers. We are undervalued. Good opportunity to buy into a nice, stable, growing company.
Excellent stuff, Jerry. Good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Hello. Good morning. Yeah, very well. Very well. Thank you. Earnings fest today. My God, it's a super Thursday. 1,001 results out around the world. So,
And do you have a system? Because I know I like to look at the RNS that's coming out. But do you have a system of going? Are there certain companies you go to? I suppose ones you may hold, you go to first. But, are there any others you'd look at this, you know, that strikes you? Or is it just, you know, the ones you hold first and then others that interest you?
Yeah, no. What I generally do with the RNS is talking just about the UK, because I look globally just to add complexity to the issue. But thinking about the UK, when the RNSs come out at 7, I literally look from the you know at them all. But the thing is, I'm just scanning the headlines. I'm thinking, do I know this company, or is it an interesting looking headline? You know, a trading update by definition is probably more interesting than a you know, buyback shares announcement or something. So it's a bit of both. And on a day like today, when it's completely mad, you're never going to be able to cover everything. But I think the discipline of just spending, you know, particularly in that golden hour before the market opens at 8, a bit of time just flicking through some real proper primary research, I tell you, you get the benefit from that. As a pro or an amateur, you get the benefit from just getting your hands a bit dirty and looking through some stuff yourself. And it doesn't matter if you see everything. Sure, start with the stuff that you own, or start with the stuff that you've thought about before, or you've looked at before, because, you know, like, it's like anything, you've kind of got a bit of a start there. You're not completely at ground zero learning about it. And then I mix it up with stuff that I find interesting, you know, just excitable looking headlines, and that takes me down different roads. But as always, I think the key is just to get enthusiastic and just crack open the computer room at 7-ish and have a look.
You're right. There's certain things you look for as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you've got to look for, you know, stuff which looks more unusual. By definition, it's like about shares. By definition, a 2 or 3% move in a share is 2 or 3 times as interesting as a 1% move. So things where there is a bit of a proper pucker change, and of course that might be driven by results, that might be driven by, you know, an extraordinary unanticipated profit warning or profit upgrade or M&A activity consolidation, etc. You know, you've just got to get active and just see what's out there. You never know. You can't predict it. That's the beautiful thing about the market.
Lovely. So what companies are you looking at today, then?
So we got three biggest today, three of the biggest. If you add them together, my God, I hate to think what proportion of the FTSE it would be. We've got Royal Dutch Shell, we've got Unilever, and we've got Vodafone. So three big ones. Mm. And I think they've all got something to say. They're probably all very well owned by a lot of investors around the UK and overseas. But there's different stories in all of them. And, you know, even though they're big and they're worthy at a certain level, they're going to persist, they're not going to go bust, etc. You've still got to think about it, because the thing is, even with your biggest investment, one which seems rock solid, you've still got to kind of filter it and have a look and say, is it still working for me? Is it still one that I should be holding in my portfolio or not? And I think this is my real frustration with some real large cap, certainly pension fund investors. My God, you know, the focus on the super long term blinds you to things, changes that are ongoing. And it means that you hold things just because they're paying a dividend, not realizing that the capital loss is way bigger than the dividend in some cases. But there you go. Yeah. Let's take a look at them. Royal Dutch Shell. Look, the thing is with Royal Dutch Shell, clearly oil price has been on fire. Mm-hmm. No pun intended there. But it's been obviously buoyed by that. And the fact is, it's justified their BG acquisition of a few years back, because the higher oil price suddenly makes that acquisition look half reasonable. And you look through the results today, and they were saying all the right things. Debt's coming down. They're committed to that very decent dividend, although I note they're not increasing it again. Gearing's come down as well. And once again, they're keeping their spending under control. It all looks absolutely fine. So the question is, why has the share come back a couple of quid from the high of a few weeks ago? And why is it slightly on the downside when I last looked today? The answer is because I think the market correctly is saying, you know, what comes next? Because Shell's been on this really prudent run. It's been cutting costs, cutting spending, running it really lean and mean to make sure that if the oil price didn't puck up, then that they wouldn't kind of run out of cash or have a real big problem, you know, have to cut the dividend or something like that. So they've been very prudent. But I think the trouble is the next iteration for these big oil companies is actually getting back on the spending front, because they've got to make sure that over the next 5 or 10 years, they've got production growth. Because the trouble is, even though Shell bought BG and that's helped a bit, some of the cutbacks they've done in recent years have kind of helped to offset that. So they've still got to get out there and spend. I think the market's coming around to that view now, that even if the oil price goes up, these companies are going to have to go out and spend a bit more. And then it depends on how sensibly they spend, how successful the oil fields are, and all those classic things which impact oil stocks. So for me, Shell's got goosed up a bit too hard and a bit too fast. It's paying you a very, very nice yield, which, as I say, was maintained today. You've got no growth in it, but it's a very decent yield at a 6% plus level at a rolling basis. But I just think when I look at it, there's a story which I'm waiting for to hear from the management, which is how are we going to see production, proper pucker production growth over the next 5 odd years? And otherwise, Shell's just a very nice sort of annuity, pays you a decent dividend yield, and is actually probably a little bit expensive, you know. So I'm waiting for the conference call later on so they can answer those questions, hopefully. But as we stand today, I think you can do better elsewhere. I think things like oil services in the energy space is much more interesting, because the big oil company is going to be forced to raise and spend more money. And as a consequence, oil services is a better spot to be in, I think, at this moment in time.
Yeah, but isn't that the case with these big oil companies? Because they have the dividends to pay. What they do is when the oil price goes down, so they cut back on production, and then all of a sudden that leads to an oil price increase. And then when it goes up, they start sort of spending lots of money again, and they also start producing lots of oil, and the oil price comes down again. So it's boom-bust nature, isn't it?
That's fine, but the trouble is, what you value that as an investor, because obviously there you're deepening the business cycles, you're kind of cutting back at the wrong time or putting money in at a difficult time. And the trouble is, that means that what you're prepared to sort of pay for that is less than perhaps a more solid company, which kind of rolls less aggressively with the cycle. So for me, Shell is a complete yield play right here, right now. And if I was looking for capital growth, I'd look in oil services still. And, you know, names like Wood Group, which I think ultimately is going to have bought Amec at a very good time, you know, that still seems a bit more attractive to me.
Yeah, marvellous. Okay, so is it Unilever next?
Unilever, yeah. No, well, Unilever's a funny one. Obviously, they had that sort of bid approach a year or two ago, and they turned them down. That came from Kraft. Mm-hmm. And you look at the share price today and you think, wow, that was actually a sensible thing to do, because the share's 40 quid. And before the bid approach, you know, the shares were sort of in the lower 30s. So, you know, in a certain level, management have done okay in turning down Kraft's bid, mm-hmm. and sort of been focused on their own internal initiatives to try to sharpen up Unilever. And they've had a little bit of success in that. I looked at the numbers today and I thought, these numbers are absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with them. They're making all the right noises about pushing more into the emerging markets, focusing on higher growth areas, all the stuff investors want to see. You get a reasonable yield, 3% and change. You know, everything looks fine. The trouble is, you look at Unilever shares, and I think this may be the point you and I talked about in the summer, and just they've just got a bit fruity. The trouble is that people sort of viewed these kind of international consumer staple type of businesses as we've just got to own these, you know, we've just got to, this is our way to access the world, it's safe, it's worthy, and they just got pushed up too far. The shares have fallen back 10% since the highs of sort of August, September, you know, from 44 quid down to 40 quid today. And, you know, that's a pretty decent move. That's 3 years worth of dividends, to put it into context. Now, of course, many people have got very decent capital growth on this, but my observation is, with this sort of company, you know, when it's in fashion, and it still is in fashion, you know, maybe it's not the first port of call for you. It's safe, it's worthy, but there's no value. And I looked at the numbers today and I did a couple of quick calculations and I thought, you know, you're paying over 20 times earnings, you've got a 3% yield, you've got all right cash flow, which justifies the dividend yield. It's just not cheap, though. You know, it's making the right moves, but you're paying up big time for it. And for me, I'd wait for Unilever to roll a bit further. You know, at least with Shell, you've got a very decent, you know, 5% busting yield. With Unilever, you haven't. I would chill here. I think Kraft were prepared to pay up to, you know, something probably in the high 30s. And frankly, at 40 quid, I would chill on Unilever. I would look elsewhere.
Agree. And what about the last one, the Vodafone?
Oh, Vodafone is a funny one, because, you know, we're all ever more obsessed with phones and everything else. And you'd have thought, my goodness, you know, this should be absolute manna from heaven for mobile phone companies. But of course, it's competitive. And, you know, you see that in the results of a Dixon's car phone, who obviously helps sell them to us or sell us contracts, as well as the numbers from Vodafone or EE or other players. You know, it's a competitive old market. It's a bit of a utility, to be honest. It is getting that way. Discrimination and differentiation comes much more maybe at the mobile phone level rather than the actual telecommunications spot. VOD shares, look, there's some good and there's some bad in their numbers. They've reiterated everything, which is a good first step, but it's a bit like Unilever in the sense that the trouble is what you're paying up for today is a pretty firm sort of valuation for not much growth. And, you know, Vodafone have pushed into the emerging markets. It's not particularly UK-centred. It has bigger exposures in Germany, for example, than the UK. But the trouble is I looked through the numbers and it just was a little bit dull. And they reiterated everything. There's a bit of growth, but you can see the price competition impacting as well. Again, like Shell, you've got a very decent yield here, 5% and change. And to be honest, I look through the cash flow, they're going to be able to pay that. That's not a problem. So again, if you're a yield muncher, if you like yield, Vodafone, it ticks your box. The trouble is, if you're looking from a total return perspective, I can see this one rolling a bit further. Again, you know, you get back to the early part of this year, VOD shares were 240 pence, and now you're 222 pence when I last looked. So again, you've pulled back 10% in a relative blink of an eye. And I think it's all because people have said, look, it's fine, it's worthy. There was a little bit of bid talk around Vodafone, but that seems to have gone away with some of the other deals that are occurring in the sector and obviously some of the regulatory stuff. I just think this is boring. And, you know, in summary, when I look at Shell, Unilever and VODs, I think to myself, my goodness, that's a real... You're not going to make much money. You're going to pick up some yield, but you're not going to make much money, I don't think, over the next year. And, of course... That tells you one big thing. You have got to get properly active with your stock picking and be prepared sometimes to hold a bunch of cash and to take some profits and to move things around. And I think that's the world we live in. It's a world of opportunity. But after 8-9 years of QE, there's not a lot of natural value in markets. You know, you've got to pick and choose your spots. Maybe something which is a bit more mixed in terms of general investor sentiment, something where you're actually... picking up what we talked about earlier, you're jumping off an R&S state and you're seeing something which many people aren't seeing and you're taking a view on it. You know, get properly active, get your hands dirty with your investment selections. That's my feeling for 2018. And when I look at these biggest of the big companies in the FTSE 100, that's the feeling I get. For goodness sake, don't buy a tracker fund. I just don't think it's going to be a worthy thing to do this year.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, if you've never, ever bought any shares before, and you want to get active, or you want to maybe start with a tracker fund and look at what they're buying and then do some research. But as you said, the key here is always reading and research. You know, the more you do, the luckier you'll get, the better you'll get. And that's sort of it. And it's free. You know, you can get most RNSs for free, most services do it for free. So you have access to the information pretty much anyone else does. And like I said, you'd be surprised. The more you do, and the more you... It is a thing. You learn about stocks and shares over a while. And it's like any sort of trade. But like I said, reading is invaluable, I find.
Yeah, no, you just got to... And, you know, don't think that there's a huge barrier to entry. There isn't. No. Write down a few thoughts. What's your instinct? What's your gut feel? Does it make sense to you? Does it seem good? What are they promising? Do they deliver? And this is why I always say just, you know, you don't need to be some kind of big investment geek or anything. You can write a few things down, store it on a computer, go back and look at it. You know, writing a few things down, the compounding power of that, the usefulness of that, I cannot underestimate how important that is. And you'd be amazed how too many people still that they'll just work on hot tips or something. And that has a role, don't get me wrong, but actually to make real money in markets or to feel confident when other people aren't confident, it comes from you.
It comes from
doing a bit of work yourself and jumping off other people's ideas and thoughts and inspirations and saying, yeah, I agree with that because of this.
Chris, the amount of times I've been in a stock and I've really researched it and written a blog on it and liked it a lot, then the share price has gone down and I bought some more, because the story hasn't changed. And I thought, well, and I'm, you know, because I've done a bit of research, I'm so confident on it, they think, well, listen, this is cheaper, it's a bargain. And anywhere else in the world, you know, if your favourite trainers or shoes or anything or dessert or food got reduced, you'd buy more of it. But yet in the stock market, if you haven't researched, it will breed fear. And sometimes it begets more selling. And then, to me, that's even a bigger opportunity if nothing's really changed on the story. And as long as you have your risk and exposure correct in your portfolio management, then you're fine. You can take advantage when others are running. Like Warren Buffett says, you know, be greedy when others are fearful. And that's when you earn money, you know.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Absolutely. That's the key. And the key is doing a little bit of research goes a long way. So there you go. So, you know, that's how I work. You know, with these three big companies today, I cracked open their numbers. I looked at their presentations. I got a feel. And then I'm thinking, okay, well, how do I interpret this? And, of course, that's the slightly a more experienced thing, you know, interpretation. But you've got to start somewhere. Everyone's got to start somewhere. Yeah. And if you don't start, then you may not have the success that you want.
Exactly. Marvellous, Chris. Thanks for that. And I'll let you get back on to reading a load of RNSs now and from around the world. And we'll hopefully be finishing time for next week's chat. All right?
Absolutely. Sounds a good plan. See you soon.
All right. It's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, United Oil and Gas, UKOG. At four, Upland Resources, UPL. At three, Capita, CPI. At two, Lions Gold, LION. And number one, it's I3E Energy. That's I3E ticker, of course. Worth doing research on those, I think. And, well, most of the companies here. Upland Resources, definitely. Okay. Of course, I'm biased saying that because I do hold those stocks, but do some research on them, please. Okay, top five most liked RNSs on Vox Market are at five, Frontera Resources, commencement of operations at Well T45. At four, Main Energy, operations update. At three, Harvest Minerals, directorate change. Of course, old colleague Dave Burton is now non-executive director. At two, quarterly production summary and operations update. Who is that for? I have to check. I think it's Metal Tiger. And number one, most liked RNS was from Ascent Resources, presentation to Oil Capital Conference. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz, discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.